So the scripture reading is from Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 to 6. And I will be reading from the Common English Bible. Isaiah chapter 60. Arise, shine, your light has come. The Lord's glory has shone upon you. Though darkness covers the earth and gloom the nations, the Lord will shine upon you. God's glory will appear over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to your dawning radiance. Lift up your eyes and look around. They are all gathered. They have come to you. Your sons will come from far away, and your daughters on caregivers' hips. Then you will see and be radiant. Your heart will tremble and open wide, because the sea's abundance will be turned over to you. The nation's wealth will come to you. Countless camels will cover your land, young camels from Midian and Ephah. They will all come from Sheba carrying gold and incense, proclaiming the Lord's praises. I don't often focus on Isaiah or turn there often myself, although some of the pastors that I've been talking to over the Christmas season are of the mind that Isaiah should be considered the fifth gospel because it makes so much reference, at least in a prophetic sense, so much reference to Jesus and his arrival. Now, when we look at passages like this, it sort of points to a valid question about power. And so I've got the first three verses up on the slide now. And the question about power that I struggle with sometimes is, how much power should the church have? How much power is appropriate for Christians to demonstrate in the political arena, in economic spheres, whatever? And there are obvious sort of two extremes on this. There are some people who say, well, obviously God has given us a spirit of power. We are servants of the Most High God, the embodiment of power, knowledge, wisdom. Why would we have anything other than power? Why should we be timid? Why should we be fearful? And so with that kind of mindset, then church leaders in various parts of the world try to sort of wiggle their way into halls of power. And sometimes what happens is political leaders, when they see here's a group of people that have power, then I need to sort of hitch my wagon to their powerful horse, I guess, to mix the metaphors together. And in order to get their votes, then I have to promise them certain actions. And then that group has more power because their interests are aligned. The politician wants to get elected, and the church or a political body representing the church wants to have certain policies changed. And so those two forces can rise together and exercise power. Is that a good thing? There are a spectrum of opinions on that question. On the other side, then, there are people who say, no, the church should have no power. And these are people within the church who will say this. They would say, listen, we as human beings, a lot of people would say, we're garbage even in God's eyes, that we are created at the very lowest of creation. We continually sin, we mess up every decision in our lives, and God should be punishing us, and any sort of power that we get, any strength that we claim, actually interferes with our relationship with God because we are weak and we are supposed to have our mindset towards that weakness. So then if we should just be quiet and not have any power, then we let the state, we let the government do everything, we do everything that they say because they have the power, God has put them in power, and God has put us outside of power. So those are the two extremes. And Mennonites have generally kind of tended towards the less power end of the spectrum, that we put ourselves there, we put ourselves on the weak end of the spectrum intentionally so that we can identify with the weaker people in society, and because we recognize that power has a corrupting influence. And so we generally, as Mennonites, try to stay on the less power end of that spectrum. So there's an element of power in not only in this writing in Isaiah, but also in the story of the wise men. I wasn't part of this group, but I knew a bunch of people who went over to Afghanistan sort of around, there was a peaceful time in sort of east-west relations, and so there were some Americans and Canadians in Afghanistan, and they were talking about culture, they were talking about politics and religion in good and constructive ways. And one of the stories that these people brought back was some questions and comments that the Afghans had about Western popular culture. They said, there's one thing we don't understand. We love, and they said this, and it's true around the world, we love American movies. But we don't understand why you do. Which sounded like a strange accusation. Well, of course Americans love American movies. But the Afghans went on to explain. Listen, all of your heroes from your favorite movies, Luke Skywalker, Rocky Balboa, the list goes on, all of them are underdogs. They are weak. They don't have the strength they need, but they have inner character, and because of their character, they are able to overcome the dominant power. And, right, that's the storyline. But the Afghan said, but you Americans are the dominant power. In Star Wars, Luke Skywalker would be defeating the Americans. In the Rocky movies, which is a little bit dated, I guess, but in the Rocky movies, the hero would be a small, unknown Afghani boxer, not the world champion American one. So why is it that we in the West, despite our political power and economic power, why is it that we love underdog stories? Our Bible is full of them too. David and Goliath is the classic underdog story. Nobody tell me the score if you're following it, but there's a hockey game happening right now. Right? And we, as Canadians, we are rooting for Team Canada. We also love underdogs, but Canada is never the underdog in hockey. Never. Whenever somebody beats Canada in hockey, they get to celebrate because they've defeated the giant the same way that we celebrate anytime we beat the Americans at anything. But we root for the big, strong empire, to use the Star Wars term, and the rest of the world roots for the underdogs, and when we lose, when Canada loses, we're defeated. We feel sad as a nation because our team lost. They weren't able to overcome. Well, the other team overcame. If the dominant power wins, they didn't overcome anything. They just continued to be dominant. So, why is it that we love underdog stories? There are various parts of the three wise men story that I think highlight the underdog aspects of Jesus' birth. But even I thought these three verses were really good at sort of painting this dichotomy. So in the first verse, it says, I'll turn back here, "Arise, shine, your light has come, the Lord's glory has shined upon you," right? This is something you say to someone who has power, to someone who has inner light, to someone who is accustomed to radiance. "Arise, shine, your light has come." And then the very next verse, "Though darkness covers the earth and gloom the nations, the Lord will shine upon you, God's glory will appear over you," right? So even though there's darkness everywhere, there's darkness in your nation, there's darkness in the nations around you, there's just darkness that you can't escape, but God will still shine on you despite the darkness. Right? So that's the non-power side. And then the third one, "Nations will come to your light and kings to your dawning radiance." I had a professor who, in a situation like this, we would go around the room and we would say what our different Bible translations would say. Dawning radiance probably isn't going to be what all of them say. But we need something poetic here. Your dawning radiance, right? The dawn of a new era, the dawn of days when the sun is coming up. Your dawning radiance. And so this is kind of the underdog. The light within you is dawning. It's just beginning. Your translation will say something else, probably equally poetic. But these three verses sort of, I think, highlight that disparity of you have power, you shouldn't have power, you're going to be getting more power, and we sort of want to fit somewhere in between there. The story of Jesus' birth is an underdog story in a lot of different ways. And so I thought what I would do is go through the story of the coming of the Magi and highlight the ways that power informs this story. And so you know the story very well, but I'll go through verse by verse and talk about power, the influence of power, and how it informs what's happening here. So the story begins, so if you're following along, this is Matthew chapter 2, and I'll be reading verses 1 through 12. And we do have a pile of extra Bibles in the back. We do have open Wi-Fi if you want to read it on your phone or tablet. And all of the Bibles at the back, those are also Common English, if that makes it easier to follow what I'm reading. So it says, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, in the territory of Judea, during the rule of King Herod, Magi came from the east to Jerusalem." So the introduction here, which already sort of adds to what was explained before, right? The Gospel of Matthew introduces who Jesus is within the Jewish context. It starts with a genealogy beginning with Abraham and follows all the way through a whole bunch of weird stories and then gets to Joseph, and this is the context of who Jesus is. And then the birth is explained within the context of this sort of scandalous conception of Mary. And then the context of chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 2, is the political situation. So what sort of political situation were you born into? You would probably have to do the math to figure out who was prime minister when you were born, because it doesn't really change much of your identity. Some of you will not have been born here, and then who was in charge in the other country, you probably know that better. But Jesus' birth is given in a political context. So who is in charge? Well, King Herod is in charge, but he's not in charge of Israel. He's in charge of the territory of Judea. The territory, this word right here indicates they aren't an independent nation, right? King Herod isn't an independent king. King Herod hasn't risen up to become king of a land. He hasn't inherited the kingdom through a succession of rightful rulers. He is overseeing the territory that is largely controlled by the Roman emperor. So Jesus is born subject to King Herod, who is subject to the Roman emperor. That's the power that informs the situation. So the wise men come from the east. It's sort of generic. It doesn't say what country exactly. So they come from the east and they ask, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We've seen his star in the east and we've come to honor him. So this brings up other questions about power because they haven't said a geographic place. Right? We understand kings to have power over geography. And so it's interesting that they're looking for the king of a people. Now, Israel, of course, at that time was understood to be the land of the Jews. But if you've read through the Old Testament, you'll know that by this time, the people of Israel had spread out. Sometimes by their own choosing, because things weren't great in Israel. Sometimes by the edict of other kings who would take their families to a new land. And so, sure, some of them had come back and reestablished Israel. There were still Jews all over the place. And that diaspora, as it's called, has continued. But they've come to find the king of the Jews. They're looking for a cultural king as well as, or instead of, a geographic king. And they've come to pay homage to this king. Now, this begs a whole bunch of questions. So where are these guys coming from? And how did they know that there was going to be a king coming, especially since King Herod, who would seem to be in a position to know about coming kings, is surprised by this. I mentioned before the diaspora, the spreading out of Jews. Well, when they would go, they would bring their documents with them. A lot of times the prophets of the nation would be sent out because they had spoken truth to power in the wrong ways. And so somehow some prophetic writings had gotten to these scholars when they hadn't gotten to Herod, and they haven't gotten to us. We don't know what those documents said because we don't have a copy of them. But they've come from far away, and partly the gifts are an indication of where. There were very specific places where frankincense and myrrh were grown. But these men have come from far away, and somehow they've gotten some documents that point them to the arrival of this king. And we know very little about them. We don't know if they recognized any of the sort of deeper religious significance of this moment. We don't know if they recognized the Jewish God as being their own, or if they were simply sort of paying a gesture to a neighbor, that sort of sentiment. We don't know any of that, but we know that they have come and they have brought gifts. Well, we don't know about the gifts yet, but they've come to pay honor to this king. Now, going forward here, it says, when King Herod heard this, he was troubled, and everyone in Jerusalem was troubled with him. So what does it take to trouble the king? What does it take to trouble someone in power? Well, I think this passage, this verse, illuminates us about the kind of power that King Herod had. So King Herod might have felt threatened by this, right? Is there a new king that's going to threaten my throne? Well, he was troubled by the threat to his throne, but as I mentioned before, King Herod wasn't in charge through a democratic process. King Herod wasn't the sole decision maker for that land. He was in charge only so far as the Roman government would allow him to be in charge. So he's in charge as long as there are no problems. And if there are problems, he's no longer in charge. And so if a group of people say, hey, we've got a new king here, they're going to cause problems, When the Romans find out about it, Herod is no longer in charge. Or the people of Israel will say to Rome, hey, we have a different king. Herod means nothing to us. And then Rome might step in and say, okay, if this other king is going to be less trouble than Herod, then he's king and Herod is out. So Herod is troubled for a lot of different reasons, but primarily because Herod doesn't actually have power. Herod is afraid of power. Herod is afraid of the power of Rome. Herod is afraid of the power of insurrection if there's going to be a popular uprising from below. And Herod, I believe, is afraid of the spiritual power that Jesus represents. Because for Herod to be afraid of this new king, he has to sort of understand what's going on. But when we don't understand is often when we're more afraid. So Herod didn't know there was a new king coming. Herod didn't know where these men would have heard about that. But who else would have gone without Herod's notice to tell them that a new king was coming, that they should come and announce this? Herod is in charge, but he hasn't been able to stop this. Somehow these people think there's going to be a new king, and if they think it, how long before other people think it? Herod is afraid of power because he doesn't have power. So, going forward, it says, he gathered all the chief priests and the legal experts, and he asked them where the Christ was to be born. Herod gathered the people with legal power and the people with spiritual power, and he asked them where the new king would be born, where the Messiah was to be born, the Christ was to be born. So here in the Gospel of Matthew, it says where the Christ was to be born. A lot of times we sort of behave as though Christ was Jesus' last name. Christ is the Greek translation of a Hebrew word, Messiah, the anointed one. So Herod is saying, where is the anointed one? The one anointed for the spiritual task. Where is he supposed to be born? And the people with legal power and the people with spiritual power, they have an answer. They say, in Bethlehem. And then they refer to the prophets. Reading verses 5 and 6, it says, they said in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what the prophet wrote. You, Bethlehem, land of Judah, by no means are you the least among the rulers of Judah, because from you will come one who governs, and who will shepherd my people, Israel. So these people, the legal experts and the religious experts, they don't have the power to determine that themselves, right? They don't sit down and say, we think it would be good if the next king was born somewhere. They are simply interpreting what's written in the documents that they've been handed from before. They don't have their own power either. They are relaying to Herod, the one also who has artificial power, what the documents of power actually say. Right? This isn't their determination. This isn't their assessment of what it should be. It's their reading of the scriptures. And then not only does the prophecy say Bethlehem, it'd be enough if it just said the Messiah will someday come and will be born in Bethlehem. But that's not what it says. It's tacked on to a whole bunch of other statements about power. And Herod seems to gloss over the rest of it because he's only concerned about the geographic location. So Bethlehem is going to be the place. And it says here, by no means are you the least, right? By no means do you have the least power among all of the rulers or the powers of Judah, because from you will come one who governs. You may be the least powerful of the tribes, but from you will come the most powerful one. You have little power, but the one with the most power will come from you. The one who governs, the one who will shepherd my people, Israel. So the one who has been anointed for this task is going to be the shepherd, right? If we're going to make metaphors of power, the shepherd isn't really the most powerful image that we could think of. Certainly not in our day, where we don't really see shepherds, but in this day, shepherds lived way out in the wilderness with a whole bunch of smelly sheep, and they sort of picked up the smell of those animals. And so shepherds were not upheld as the pinnacles of society. And so here, the Christ is going to shepherd the people, which is in some ways an insult to the leader and an insult to the people. Because the one who's going to lead us is going to be a shepherd, which means that all of us are sheep. And so Herod hears all of this prophetic wisdom about the kind of power that the Messiah is going to have, and all he grabs from it is the one piece of data: where? So then this information is given to the wise men. Then in verse 7 it says, "Then Herod secretly called for the Magi and found out from them the time the star had first appeared." So from this, Herod does the math to think of when the star must have appeared, when the baby was born. We don't really see that anywhere in the scriptures that we have. Maybe now Herod has pieced together something from what the Magi have brought with them. But this is supposed to be there's a particular point. When the star appeared, must be when the baby was born, and that'll be sort of the marker. So Herod is concocting this plan in his mind of what he's going to do to demonstrate his own power. But the way he's doing that is by referring to a message that appeared in the heavens. He says, "I'm going to exercise my power. I'm going to destroy this threat to my legitimacy as king." But to do that, he has to overcome the cosmos, right? In the heavens, for the people of Israel, the heavens weren't a collection of gas balls floating in the sky emitting light. These were people in some ways. These were personified figures in the skies. And so for the cosmos to indicate that a child had been born indicated power. Herod makes this reference, "When did the star appear?" to indicate the birth of this child, because I'm going to kill that child, without recognizing the cosmological connection there. So then he goes on, he says, "He sent them to Bethlehem saying, 'Go and search carefully for the child. And when you found him, report to me so that I too may go and honor him.'" Right? So there's a lot going on here in terms of power as well. This is where it is. I've used my power to get this information. I'm giving it to you so you can go stay as long as you want, search carefully. And he may have given them extra resources or people to go with them. "And then come back to me." Then come back to me. So this is also sort of, I have power and I expect you to come back to me. Right? This isn't, the kings don't gently ask questions. Right? He's saying, go there, do whatever you want, but then come back, because I'm the king and I order that. "And then when I get there, I will pay homage too." Right? I will lower myself to recognize this new king. Right? And so Herod is sort of outside of this. He's wanting to demonstrate his own power. His story is falling apart, right? "Because I'm the king, come and tell me about it so that I can also go and be subject to this figure." Herod is really an interesting kind of poetic character, because he's in between the powers represented in this story. "When they heard the king, they went, and look, the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy." Right? So it doesn't mention the Magi. It doesn't mention their emotions at any other part of the story. It doesn't say they were excited to see the star in the first place, or that they were excited to arrive in Bethlehem, or that they were excited to meet King Herod. All of those would have been big events for them, no mention of their emotions. Israel is troubled by their announcement, but they weren't troubled. Finally, they are excited when the star reappears. They are excited because they have made the connection with the cosmological power. And I know cosmological is a big word, but the power from above. So, verse 11, they entered the house, saw the child with Mary, his mother, falling to their knees. They honored him. Then they opened their treasure chests and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, because they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod. They went back to their own country by another route. So they brought these gifts, and these gifts represent wealth, as I explained to the children. The gifts represented wealth, and sort of each of them worked as a kind of currency so that the family could buy the things that they needed. Also, they represent to us, the story readers, where they've come from. But in verse 12, the closing of the story reconnects us with the power structure that's going on here. Because the Magi are unaware of a lot of things. They seem to be unaware of the hostility between Herod and this threatening king. They don't know Israel, they don't know the culture, they don't know the history, they only know that there's supposed to be a new king. So their plan was to go back to Herod and fulfill the request that the king had given them. That's what you do when the king asks you to do something. So they're about to go back to Herod, but then they are warned in a dream. And in Scripture, dreams are more important than our dreams are today. So they have a dream, presumably each of them, they communicate these dreams to each other. They have this dream. The dream says, don't go back to King Herod, go another way. Another sign to us, the reader, that the bigger power is not Herod. Right? The bigger power, the power behind the story, is not the king who's sitting temporarily on the throne. The Magi go back. We don't know anything about where they went back to, what stories they told when they got there. Those records haven't survived. They've gone back, and the rest of the story is unfolding behind the scenes. Jesus and his family will have to run to Egypt to be safe there. Jesus gradually builds up more and more power until he's finally a threat to the state and he's executed. But then he rises back from the dead and brings out a new kingdom. He was the king of the Jews, right? The king of a non-specific place. But then he is the king of kings. Then he's bringing about the kingdom of God, right? The kingdom that Jesus represents is not a geographic one. And so this is our king. And the reminder for us in this story isn't just that there was a historical King Herod who didn't actually have real power. This is also a reminder for us that the present day King Herods don't actually have real power either. Yeah, they have the power to launch drone strikes. They have the power to send people to prison. They have that kind of power, but their power is temporary. Their power is limited. Their power is in many ways artificial, and they are as afraid of that power being taken from them as King Herod was in this story. But our king, the king that we serve, doesn't demonstrate power like that. The king that we serve doesn't demonstrate power by killing and destroying. So we, the subjects of that king, don't get to do that either. We don't get to celebrate when other kings do that. This is the king that we follow, the king whose arrival troubles the political world. So if we're going to follow this king, if we're going to live in this kingdom, then we have to follow the one who shepherds us. So may we draw near to Jesus, may we draw near to God the way that the sheep draw near to the shepherd, not the way that the subjects of the king fall in fear for their lives in front of the king. We fall before our king with love, knowing that God's radiance will grow and our radiance will grow as well. Amen.